The next case in our calendar is 99-444, Mark Weiss, DBA Center West Realty Company versus the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio. Justice Cook has recused herself in this case. We're very pleased to have her sitting in the place of Justice Cook. Judge Judith Chrisley, who is a judge of the Court of Appeals in the 11th District. Mr. Lansdowne.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Dennis Lansdowne, along with Mary Kavanaugh, Frank Fischetelli, and the appellant, Mark Weiss. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
Thank you. The essential issue before this court is whether an electric utility can create two classes of otherwise identical consumers and harshly discriminate against the captive consumer in favor of the consumer who has an alternative source of electric power. Despite the legislature's clear prohibition against this discrimination, the answer, based upon the comprehensive statutory scheme and this court's interpretation of those statutes, must be no. The utility cannot classify these customers in this manner for the utility's sole benefit. It is important to note that this is a classification case. There is no question that CEI has separated consumers into two separate classes. Mark Weiss and others similarly situated do not have access to another source of power or in one class, and those that do have access to that other source of power are in another class.
Does the record reflect that CPP offered lower rates to the CEI?
The record really doesn't reflect anything about the facts before the commission as far as the competitive nature between CEI and CPP, only that they compete. But CPP does have access to other, to cheaper sources of energy, and there may be, it may be that they do offer cheaper electricity, but there is no facts in the record.
If CPP did in fact offer lower rates, how is CEI being competitive with
them? CEI can be competitive and is competitive with CPP in a number of ways. They've been competing with CPP for nearly 100 years. They do it on the basis of their better reliability of service, better response to complaints, continuity of service, the fact that they have a larger service team. So they compete in a number of ways. Well, there may be a competitive advantage for CPP that the legislature recognized when it permitted a municipal utility to exist. The legislature recognized that there was going to be this competition and that the municipal utility may have the ability to offer less cheaper rates, but it did not authorize the utility to classify customers on the basis of that. Classification, the statute that addresses classification is 4905.31d.
That's the environment of CPP does offer lower rates. People that are in the service areas of CPP have an option that your client doesn't have, is that correct?
They have the option to get CPP, yes.
And that does create a distinction from what your client is doing.
It creates a distinction.
And did this fact that the commission reject an application to an area that didn't have the competition, just on the subdivision that made in the education?
Yes, the commission sliced up the city into three separate so-called competitive zones.
So if you didn't have CPP, you really couldn't work through that was offering a special deal.
Right. If you have no access to CPP, you're not in that class. But 4905.31d is the specific statutory provision that says when a utility may separate, may classify consumers. And that statutory provision tells you that the permissible bases relate relate to quantity use, time when used, duration of use, purpose for which used, and a general provision following which says any other reasonable consideration. This court has consistently interpreted that language to limit classifications to those based on price, the cost of providing the service, or the unique needs of the customer, not on the basis of competition. The classifying customers on the basis of the competitive desires of the utility, CEI in this instance, is not permitted by the statute. So whether or not the commission may think it's a good idea, or CEI may think it's a good idea to do this and to have this competition, the General Assembly, as Justice Stratton noted in the Ohio Edison case, the General Assembly makes policy regarding the expansion or restraint of free trade.
Mr. Ransdowne, does the deregulation legislation negate or eliminate the certified territories provision?
Well, the deregulation legislation will replace a lot of the statutes that are issued.
Including the protected territories, the Certified Territories Act.
Yes.
If that's the case, this is not likely to arise again, is it?
Not in precisely this fashion, but it is not moved because of the fact that this has gone on for 7 years to the detriment of Mr. Weiss and many others similar to the situation.
So what would you be looking for? Damages for allegedly excessive charges?
Under the statute, those who are damaged by the discriminatory pricing would be entitled to bring an action in common pleas court. That is what...
For the damages that you're alleged you suffered. Okay, now is there a statute of limitations with regard to that time period?
Well, the statute of limitations, we believe, would be told during the pendency of our PUCO claim. We would be able to go back at least that far.
A full 7 years, or at least?
At least back to 97, but we believe that the full 7 years is an ongoing situation.
But really, the deregulation, I wouldn't see how this could arise again under deregulation. I guess that's why I'm asking whether or not this is a... because the statute seems to support the PUCO's position. The equities may not. The statute does. I mean, whenever the PUCO grants them the right to create these classifications or the competitive act, how do we say, PUCO, you've erred because you violated the statute?
Because the statute, Your Honor, 4905.31d, mm-hmm. says the basis upon which they can make these classifications, and the competitive desires of the utility is not one of those bases. It is limited, and this court has so interpreted, to be limited to cost differential or the particular needs of the customer. And realizing that it is not an enumerated basis, CEI and the Commission try to expand the language, the general language, any other reasonable consideration, to include competitive needs. But that is not appropriate, as this court has limited that language to the enumerated items before it. And that is consistent with the statutory construction doctrine, justum generis, that this court has applied, mm-hmm. in which when the legislature uses enumerated terms and a general term, the general term is limited by those enumerated.
If we follow that argument, then, had they thought that they were bound by the proposition that you're stating, would they then had the Hobson's choice of saying, okay, go buy your electricity from someplace else, we can't sell it to you because we know you can get it at a lesser price, and that's why we're entering into the contract, but we can't sell it to you, and then you'd have had no cause of action, and they wouldn't have sold electricity.
Well, they are required to supply electricity to Mr. Weiss, who's in their service area.
Well, yeah, I understand to your client, but I'm talking about they had to choose whether or not according to you, whether they were going to violate the statute or not sell to who you're saying is a competitor, the people in the other class. Isn't that right?
Well, the people in the other class, they can sell to the people in the other class. They just have to sell it on the same basis that they supply it to Mr. White.
But obviously, the people in the other class can buy it for less.
Well, they can, and again, the legislature recognized that.
So what you're saying is they should have sold it to both of you for less.
Yes.
And negated the contract they had with you already.
Well, they can either supply it to both of us under the same, the cheaper rate or the cheaper benefits, or they can supply it under the more expensive rate, as long as they do it equally, and they can compete with CPP as they have done for 100 years by emphasizing things like their service and other bases to compete. They have not been shy about competing with CPP other than with price. And the fact that they have been competing for over 100 years, and the commission and CEI have not been able to cite a single case to this court in which this type of classification based upon the competitive needs of the utility has ever been permitted by this court or the court of any other state in the country with a similar statutory background. So that fact alone should give us pause as to whether this is a legitimate basis upon which to classify. They do cite the all-net case, but that is not, in fact, a classification based upon competition, in that case involving interchange, local and long-distance interchange companies. The court specifically said they were all being treated equally. So that is not a classification based upon that. Based upon competition. Similarly, the ARMCO case that the CEI and the Commission tried to rely on is not a classification case in any sense. In that case, of course, simply approved a flexible rate but applied to all classes the same.
So conceding the 31 contracts, the 490531 contracts are subject to the 33 and 35 sections. Conceding that for a moment, are we down then to determining whether or not the differentiation between these customers falls into the classification of reasonable classification of customers? That's really what we're interpreting, aren't we?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that with 31D sets forth whether it's permissible to classify. If it's not permissible to classify on that basis, then it's per se discriminatory under 33 and 35. And so our contention is that the classification is not permissible under 31D, and therefore it follows that it is discriminatory under 33 and 35.
So that's what we are interpreting. The words, is this a reasonable classification?
The language is other reasonable consideration that follows the specific enumerated bases in the in 490531. See that my time is up. I've saved 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Lansdowne. Mr. Wright.
Clearly found in its order approving this program. The
commission made quite clear that customers that do have a competitive alternative, in this case, Clayton Public Power, are not similarly situated to customers who lack that alternative and are not served under the same conditions and circumstances as customers who lack that alternative.
Council, help us understand the overall thrust of this program. Anybody reads the newspaper knows that the CEI has been fighting the Muni Power in Cleveland forever, the mayors.
That is really is correct.
General war over this. As I understand it, the commission has, under this statute, allowed CEI to drop its rates where it has to compete with Muni Power, to offer a lower rate to customers where it has to compete.
In part.
Is that correct?
In part.
Right. And there's a reference when the commission talks about this, and the statutes are designed to protect the rest of power companies' customers from having to suck up the burden of this effort to compete with a competitor. And is that what this reference to the Delta revenues, the commission says we think we've protected the rest of CEI's customers by our careful balancing of the limited rate reduction through the protection of the remaining customers through our Delta revenue policy? Is that what is meant there?
Your Honor, when the commission approved of this road, it made quite clear that any revenue shortfall associated with these contracts would be borne exclusively by the utility shareholders. Ergo, the customers would not be asked to pay a penny of that, and in fact have not paid a penny of that. Your Honor's premise is also correct about the beneficial nature of this program. This program essentially recognizes the competitive realities of the Cleveland marketplace. Cleveland Public Power and CEI have competed for customers for years. The Commission has approved a number of contracts, gas, electric, telephone, that provide competitive response availability for utilities.
And do they do that? Their effort is to balance, or do they try to help the one side gain an advantage of the other? What's their threshold there? Do they let CEI undercut Muni Power, or do they say you can only go down to
the Commission's focus in approving these contracts is the protection of the regulated utilities customers, all its customers. And as the Commission made quite clear in this case, its approval of this program, which is implemented through individual 30-month contracts, was intended to allow CEI to retain customers in the face of it.
So their goal is to allow CEI to have a big customer base, even so conceivably, because they don't regulate the munis, their goal would say, well, Cleveland's a nice plum, so why don't we help you get it off?
Your Honor, that the premise behind competitive response contracts is that some revenue is better than no revenue, if you will. By approving these contracts, the Commission said, CEI, we want you to be aggressive in trying to retain contracts, retain jobs, whether they be in Cleveland or jobs that otherwise might move out of the state. And by maintaining the revenue contribution from those contracts, the rates of all customers, including Mr. Weiss and others served under tariff, are kept lower than they otherwise would be. That is the greater the benefit for the greater good, if you will, that springs from these contracts. The Commission's classification in this case, we would submit, is abundantly reasonable. Contrary to assertions from counsel, this court has long recognized the expertise of the commission in drawing that line, in classifying customers. The ARMCO case, I would cite specifically, involved the court's adoption of a commission approval of a special rate under 4905.31E. In that case, the court recognized, as did the commission, the importance of permitting regulated utilities with the ability to respond in a competitive marketplace to maximize the revenue contribution from customers that otherwise would be lost. That is precisely what we're looking at in this case. This court's decision in the 1997 Ohio Edison Youngstown Thermal case is somewhat analogous in that dealt with a situation involving regulated competition against unregulated competition. Admittedly, that was under a different statute, 4905.34, but I think what was important in that case was the court said that a regulated utility's right to contract and to compete with an unregulated supplier under 4905.34 was not limited in any way by 4905.33, the statute which the appellant relies on in this case. And I think the introductory language at that time in 4905.34 was virtually identical to the introductory language in 31. This court noted in its ARMCO decision 20 years ago that 4905.31 expressly overrides any other provision in Chapter 45. Now, the commission, in its decision, didn't go that far. The commission did go on to analyze the claims made by Mr. Weiss under 4905.33 and 135. And that's why it's important that the court recognize that this is not a case of similarly situated customers. The commission made that quite clear. 4905.33 requires that customers served under virtually the same circumstances and conditions be given the same rate. The commission found that was not the case. Customers with competitive alternatives are not served under substantially the same circumstances and conditions as those that lack that alternative. 4905.35 doesn't simply require discrimination. It requires unjust discrimination. That is the word used in the statute. In fact, this court has noted on several occasions that discrimination per se in rate making is itself not unlawful. It has to be carried to a higher level.
Is Mr. Weiss seeking to validate all these contracts or seeking to get the same contract?
Your Honor, I believe he is attacking the characteristics of the class that qualify to participate in the program. And in so doing, I believe he's attacking the validity of the program itself. And as I indicated at the outset, hundreds of contracts are jeopardized if this court were to reverse.
Is it prayer for your need to get the same contract themselves, or was it to abolish
them? I believe it's to abolish them and place himself the questions that were asked about the remedy in this case. It's not clear. The commission noted very clearly in its order that Mr. Weiss, in any event, was not prejudiced with the commission's finding, because even in the absence of this competitive response program, competitors of his, one might say, located within Cleveland, would still qualify for lower Cleveland public power rates, and his office buildings, which are located outside the city of Cleveland, would not, because Cleveland public power does not serve that area.
That's why I asked the question about the damages issue, because it seems to me if we reverse the commission and he makes some good arguments, but if the commission's reversed, as I understand it, then that's going to permit him to go to the Common Pleas Court, determine what amounts to a rate case in the Common Pleas Court. And
Your Honor, that's not entirely clear. I would suggest that this might be a detail situation
yeah.
as well,
yeah.
where damages, I believe, would be unavailable because the commission's order for the until proven otherwise would have been lawful.
Again, that's why I asked the question. Are you two, your two best cases, Armco and the Edison case?
I think those are two of them, and another one comes to mind with respect to this classification issue, Your Honor. This court's decision in the 1980 County Commissioner's case clearly upheld the commission's classification of customers on the basis of ability to pay. That case involved what rates should be charged to schools. And the commission noted in that case the
yeah.
factors surrounding schools, the way they're funded, and their ability to pay. And the commission made that classification, and this court upheld that classification. Nowhere will you find in Title 49 expressly ability to pay is a proper criteria to classify customers.
When I read your proposition of law number one, it seems to me you're saying that, let's call them, for lack of a better name, 31 contracts.
Yes.
That a contract pursuant to 31 is in fact a special sort of thing and it's exempt from the 33 and the 35 requirements.
That is correct.
Okay. Take for purposes of argument that I don't agree with that. I think that they are subject to 33 and 35 requirements. That's when you get to the reasonable classification status, isn't it?
That is
okay.
Correct.
Now if that's yeah, that's what I thought too, and that's why I wondered why you're arguing that they're absolutely exempt under 31. But let me go to the real question then. If in fact we found that they were exempt under 31 contract was exempt from the provisions of 33 and 35, would not that permit any 31 contract to do whatever it wanted to do even if it was unreasonable?
No, Your Honor, it wouldn't, because the reasonable standard would still govern.
Where is that in statute?
That is in 4905.31, which permits any reasonable arrangement.
Reasonable arrangement, reasonable classification, not reasonable as to terms.
Your Honor, I believe the commission would, depending on the facts and circumstances that would be presented to it in that case, would have to determine whether or not the classification was reasonable and then whether or not the terms were reasonable.
So you think under a 31 contract, well, I suppose that's probably true because the commission has to approve every 31 contract.
And they
so they could say that it was not reasonable, a sale of that particular quantity or for the
that
price.
That's correct, Ron. Continuing jurisdiction of the commission over those contracts.
You don't need to make 31 contracts exempt under 33 and 35, do you, to win?
The station certainly did not, Your Honor, because they are clearly reasonable. Thank you. It was requested to confirm.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Mr. Kudyk.
Why the argument then?
I'm here on behalf of the Cleveland Aluminum Company. I'd like to address the point made by Mr. Lansdowne that somehow there's some real narrow limitation under 4905.31b and any other reasonable consideration language. As Mr. Wright noted, this court in the County Commissioners Association's case determined that there can be classifications based upon considerations other than cost and other than price. There was, in effect, a public policy decision made that people and that the commission and utilities can treat certain customers differently for the public good and in the public interest. Although that case was not a case decided under 4905.31, certainly if it passes muster under 4905.33 and 4905.35, which it did in that case, then it certainly passes muster under 4905.31.
Whether or not it's exempt.
Whether or not it's exempt. So because this program was a program that benefits competition, gives CEI the tools to compete with CDP, it's good for two reasons, if I may quickly sum up. One is competition is good, as this commission indicated, or this court indicated in the Armco case. It's good for the customers in Cleveland. It's also good for the remaining customers, as the commission determined, where it's a very basic economic principle, where you have to recover fixed costs and there are less good units sold to recover those costs, the price of those units sold will tend to go up. You sell more units, the price can remain as it is, or it certainly reduces the pressure to increase it. It was a reasonable decision of the commission. Therefore, this court should determine that the commission's decision was correct and affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Kudyk. Mr. Lansdowne, you've saved 2 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to point out that the commission never found that these customers were not similarly situated. It simply said they may not be. So it made no specific finding in that respect anyway. Secondly, the commission had failed again to cite a single case in which this kind of classification has been permitted. I submit that is because it is not permitted. The statute simply does not permit it. The issue is not whether they might think it's a good idea, or even whether it might be a good idea, in some sense, to have these competitive contracts. That may be so, but the legislature, as this court recognized, the legislature determines the extent of competition in this area, and the legislature has determined that this is not a reasonable basis for classifying customers. And the legislature has known about the competition between utilities and among utilities in the state for 100 years and has chosen not to extend that ability to the commission. The commission is not, what should the commission do next? Should it be set up and analyze the competitive needs of all the various electric utility customers in the state, pick and choose who is going to get benefits? What about the competitive needs of Mr. Weiss? Is the commission expert in analyzing those? No, it's not, and that is why the legislature has not given that authority to the commission. The ARCO case, again, does not support the analysis here. It was not a case in which classification was based upon competitive needs. It was not a case decided under 40905-31D. It was decided under E, which is a completely separate, distinct provision relating to specific contracts. So again, there's not a single case. In this case, should not be the first. We would respectfully request that the court reverse the commission and determine that this program violated 4905-31, 33, and 35. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lansdowne. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a very brief recess.
All rise. Thank you. goes in next.
This is case number 00348, Disciplinary Counsel versus David Evans. Mr. Coghlan, you may. Okay, you're going to proceed. Mr. Eiler, you may proceed. If you wish to reserve any time, please watch your clock because we don't give you any indication of the time.
Thank you very much, Judge. I'll do that. I'd like to save 5 minutes. May it please this honorable court, the entire discipline proceedings that have taken place in this case should be invalidated. And they should be invalidated because of the conflict of the law firm, of Saxby's law firm. Now, the reason that should be so is if it was wrong and conflicted in the civil case, and the decision of the trial judge there. If it was wrong in the civil case to be conflicted, it's wrong here to be conflicted. And there's no doubt about the conflict. The conflict ruling by the judge was never appealed by anybody. And so the conflict remains, never contested, but never recognized by disciplinary counsel. Either in this case, the conflict is true or it's not. If it's not, then all the proceedings that took place in the disciplinary hearing by the Chester Saxby Law Firm and former Justice Wright in this case, if that is true, then the entire proceedings is contaminated.
Would you start over again?
Say again, sir?
Do you start over again?
Can I start over again? I'm sorry, Judge.
Do you start over again?
No, of course not, Judge. We don't start over again, to my view, Your Honor, if I may. Once the jury has been contaminated, and there's only one jury here, there's not two juries, and you can't put a new jury in, you have the board, the 26, 28 members of the board. So bring the same case back to the board, to my view, is telling the same jury that made a ruling early to do it again. So I don't think we should start again. I think the charges should be dismissed, Your Honor. And so in this case, what we have here is a failure of the disciplinary counsel to recognize that the case was conflicted, so when they received knowledge of it, they never dropped the charges but proceeded. Once again, if it was wrong in the civil case, it's wrong here. There's no reason to justify it. As a matter of fact, the penalties are more severe here. All that can happen to you in the civil case is you can lose money. And that was the prayer down there. In this case, you can lose your reputation. You can vitiate the electorate, the judge's election. You can be stigmatized for the rest of your legal career. You can be removed for 6 months as a judge, which is a death knell to run again. So the penalties are more extreme than mine. I encourage the court to put the disciplinary counsel to task here on this point, because I find found it to be very, very offensive to not have recognized that the Saxby firm was conflicted from the beginning and they should have never proceeded with the case.
We should use the, when we use the verb conflicted, maybe we should be more specific to say what is, because typically it is a former client who has the right to object to counsel taking on a client who might have an adverse interest. And in this case, it would have been the other judges who had the right under the rule to complain about that. I guess when we use the term conflicted, we probably should be specific. How was Judge Evans, how was his interest adverse in the discipline, since the matter is only between the bench and the respondent? And
yes, Judge, I understand your point. Judge Nadine Miller discussed that in her opinion.
Which is a case, but I want to distinguish. That's a case where these individuals have adverse interests.
And what we will do then, Judge, we'll turn to canon number 5 at EC 19. EC 19, canon 5 says that the decision on whether or not you're conflicted rests with your client, your present client.
In this case, though, as opposed to Judge Miller, Judge Miller's case is a case where Judge Evans is suing the two judges who also consulted the firm. So we would have a case where the interests would be adverse between the two parties who at one point shared a lawyer. That's not true in the discipline case, is it?
Yes, it's absolutely true, if I may, Your Honor. The test is whether there's a substantial relationship between the two judges, Newsom and Douthat, who went to the Rocky Saxby, a relationship between that and the present discipline case. And the answer, of course, what they went to Rocky Saxby about was it's what to do about Judge Evans's advertising and the rest of his conduct throughout the thing. And, of course, that's what was brought to them. There's no doubt about that. There's not even a conflict on that. The factual evidence is overwhelming on the point that there's a reasonable relationship between what occurred with the advice given by the Saxby Chester firm, Chester Saxby firm, and that is go for the 80 media news. Remember, that was set forth in our brief. The advice that was given by the Chester firm was go to the media. And so a news release was issued about all the wrongdoing that Judge Evans had done during this campaign. So, of course, there's a relationship between that advice given to Newsom and Douthat, judges there, and what occurred to the disciplinary counsel. There's a count there.
When did Judge Evans discover this conflict?
After there was a resignation in December of 1999 of Judge Craig Wright. And so what you have here, I'm sorry, Judge, there was a question.
Yeah, I'd like to get off the conflict, and I'd like to get to the acts of the basis of the challenge for disciplinary action. You're not disputing that the act occurred, are you not?
Which acts, Judge?
Well, let's talk about the...
You mean the day advertising on the top and the failure to do a report on your campaign?
Speak to the reporting issue first.
There's no doubt the reporting issue belongs with the Board of Elections. You know, the canon itself says that. The canon refers to 3510.11. And that statute, that's where you get stuck, if you will, with failure to report on campaign. I mean, the canon doesn't do anything but...
A failure to report ever become an ethical violation?
Say again, Judge?
Can a failure to report ever become an ethical violation?
I don't see how. Not under 3510.11.
If the failure to report involves dishonesty, does that become an ethical violation?
You mean criminal dishonesty? It should go to the prosecutor. And the canon still provides for that. If there was any indication that anybody has been dishonest or fraudulent in a way, that's a crime.
But why wouldn't that also go to disciplinary court?
Because the rule says, Your Honor, under the canon, that you must comply. The canon refers you to 3517.10. When you go to 3517.10, it says these matters don't belong in discipline. They belong before the Board of Elections. It's very clear. I don't see any problem here.
Did your client authorize civil lawsuits?
Did he authorize? You mean was he talked to by Craig Wright? And
no,
Yes, he followed his lawyer's advice.
But he was the client who had the ultimate decision.
I have trouble with your word decision, Judge. I mean, if you go to a doctor and he advises you of something, you can refuse his medication and take the consequences of it. Here he had two powerful law firms, in the biggest in the state, if you will, and they said file the suit.
And he could have said no.
All right, Judge. All right, I give him a judge.
Could he have said no?
I don't think he could have said no at all. I mean, as a client, what do you mean, ultimately, what can the judge, can a client say, I don't want you to bring the suit? Yes. And incidentally, it's kind of interesting because, you see, why are we into that? Why are we into the lawsuit at all? Why are we into anything at all? If you don't believe that there was a conflict here with the Chester, Wilcox, Saxby firm, then you don't believe. And I'm wasting my time here. Put back the sanctions for 6 months suspension. You see, what we're doing here is what the disciplinary council should have done long before. Either you believe this or you don't. Incidentally, isn't it unusual that, what do we have here? Selective prosecution?
Could the two judges who perceived that these advertisements violated the canons, would it have been unethical for them to have publicly stated to a newspaper person that they themselves considered the act of their opponent to be a violation of the canons?
It would, Judge, because there was no probable cause for me to make those kind of statements. That's what I said about selective prosecution, if you will, Judge. Those were violations by Douthat, Judge Douthat. There is no question about it. You cannot make those kind of statements and claim in 80 news media and within a 14-county area. How can you do that? What are we doing here? What are the disciplinary council doing here?
Could they say that they thought that the statements were misleading? Without saying that they specifically violated the judicial canon, could they call a press conference to say that I consider my opponent to have engaged in misleading conduct in their opinion?
Well, you know, Judge, I don't know. I mean, I don't know the context of it. I think theoretically the First Amendment permits you to do that. Just like the First Amendment provided my client to say, top and many. We want to get a definitional thing? You know, Waldman, we put it in a footnote in one of our briefs. Waldman got upset with that, saying, wait a minute, top means top. Top doesn't mean all, and many doesn't mean all. No, I think that's a good point. The thing that really disturbed me so much is if there was any complaint about it, incidentally, I want to talk about this trial by ambush here because I think it's very important. Now, the civil case was known to the disciplinary counsel, and it became an aggravating factor, a punishing factor. That's what it became, punishment, because you filed a civil case. And disciplinary counsel knew that, so they laid and waited. And they laid and waited and cross-examined my client. That was Kaufman, who cross-examined my client and forced him into some admissions there, knowing full well that the civil case, instead of making it a charge, he didn't do that. And so that's the kind of treatment we're going to get from the disciplinary counsel? I don't think so. I hope not. Incidentally, the ambush also comes on the many. You know, when the notice first came from disciplinary counsel to my client, and to Craig Wright, who represented him at that time, my client responded to Top and said, we changed it to many. No complaint to many. Counsel didn't say, instead of the five charges that I filed, I'm going to add two of them more. I'm going to, the civil case, I find a charge, and the many I find is not a correction, I'm going to charge you on that. So what happened? They lay and wait. And when it's all over, they punish him again. Without an opportunity to say, look, give me a chance to change the many. Can I have a discussion about many? And no discussion at all.
Counsel,
so it's trial by ambush, Judge.
So how would you define remorse in this situation? How would it have been demonstrated?
Which, Judge?
Remorse.
Remorse?
Remorse.
I think four times I read in the transcript of the panel, He said, "I'm sorry, I wish it didn't happen." Four times. And he admitted twice, did he not? See, there was, here's how interesting this case is. 13 charges filed by Newsom. They quit within a month. They don't want it any further. He says, "You lack jurisdiction to proceed." You read that in the briefs. He said, "We lack jurisdiction to proceed." So now there's five counts. We go to the hearing and there's two counts. I mean, what kind of a disciplined case is this? From 13 down to two.
Counselor.
And there was remorse that was expressed. The man said, "I wish it hadn't happened." What are you supposed to do? What is remorse? Or is remorse defiance? We got to get on your hands and knees, crawl up Broad Street into his office and say, "I'm sorry, for the love of God, I'm sorry." What more do you need for remorse? Why are they doing this to him? 6 months suspension as a judge.
Counselor, the relator focuses on the contradiction between what he says in his complaint, that they intentionally filed false allegations with disciplinary counsel, and his admissions in the stipulations. How do you resolve that?
How do you resolve it? You resolve it on your lawyer. See, the lawyer designs the stipulations. The lawyer designed the complaint. Justice Wright, who in 1993 sat at this bench in 1993 in the Heck case and said, right? Isn't that true, Jeff? It said, and he said it specifically, that there's a privilege that attaches to filing a complaint. This is the very same lawyer that advised my client, the very same lawyer who was a judge on this bench, who said, "I'm going to file a civil lawsuit." What do we do about that?
I guess we have to look at it in the context of the client here. The client is unusual in that we have a client who's a lawyer and an appellate judge. So to take that position that the client was misled, you know, by a lawyer who had all this different knowledge, you know, I think we might have to evaluate that a little bit in terms of what the situation that you have your client.
Well, Judge, maybe it has never happened, but to my view, when somebody comes to me with a problem, they're scared to death.
Mm-hmm.
And reason leaves. You know, you have to walk in somebody's moccasins, don't you? Just for a little while to say, "Look, I trust these big mogul firms in Columbus, Ohio, because they know." And one was a chief a justice of the Supreme Court, and he ought to know. And so what, you defer. I mean, Judge, I listened to this electric case here, where I've been a lawyer for 40 years, 1960. I had no idea what they were talking about. None. Zero. So what are you going to throw, you know? So how much knowledge should you have? You turn over a case to a law firm, a prestigious law firm that has a justice of the Supreme Court formally on the case, and you say to yourself, "I trust this man." Is that unreasonable, or do we say, "I doubt this man"?
Mr. Eiler, you've used your time.
Thank you, Judge.
We'll give you a little time.
I appreciate
conclusion.
It.
Mr. Coghlan.
I'm John Coghlan, disciplinary counsel, and later in this matter. I would like to start with the issue of conflict and briefly address that. Any alleged conflict that existed in this case did not affect the defendant's respondent's representation whatsoever. What we have is an allegation that because the Chester firm represented both sides in connection with the civil case, that conflict somehow flows into this matter, and it simply does not. The judges, Newsom and Douthit, were not parties to the disciplinary case. They were not even witnesses. All they did was report the matter to the Board of Commissioners in the first instance in June of 1998. In addition, in a traditional conflict analysis where you have a former client and a present client and a conflict between the two, it is the former client that is subject to being harmed in that scenario. Applying that to these facts, it would be judges Newsom and Douthit were subject to being harmed. Why? Because they had revealed confidences to their counsel. Their counsel now represents a new party against them, as occurs in the civil case, and is subject to using their confidences against them. That has nothing to do with this matter here. Finally, I've just briefly addressed this, and counsel for responding completely ignored this point. The respondent was concurrently represented by an entirely separate and independent law firm. The firm of Pratt Brown and three members of that firm were representing him throughout the disciplinary case. There is no allegation made that the members of that firm were in any way tainted by this alleged conflict.
When was the issue of conflict first raised, and is there any waiver?
The first mention of conflict appears in the respondent's objections filed before this court. I would submit to you that the actual conflict was raised in the civil case in October, over a month before the hearing in this disciplinary matter. Mm-hmm. If you look at the record, which has now been made a part of this case by their request and granted by this court, what you find is that there are two letters, and in those letters are there are references to two phone calls. There are four different times before the hearing in this matter when the alleged conflict is brought to the attention of the firm representing the respondent in the civil case by the lawyers representing Judges Newsom and Douthat. They wrote saying, wait a minute, you, Wilcox and Saxby, cannot represent the respondent in the civil case because you advise our clients, Judges Newsom and Douthat, initially, early on, about what action they should take, about issuing the press release, which is the very issue that they sued him about.
Mr. Kaufman, you have a pretty good view of disciplinary cases and appropriate sanctions. What sanction did you recommend the panel impose?
I stipulated and recommended that the sanction should be 6 months stayed.
Do you think that were you surprised by the full board's actually imposing the 6 month sanction?
Actually, I wasn't. I think that the evidence that was adduced at the hearing justifies where the board went.
Well, you knew about that when you made your recommendation.
Well, I knew the civil suit existed. I had no idea what position the respondent was going to take when I asked him, how do you reconcile the inconsistency between saying in your civil suit, I'm going to sue you, Judges Newsom and Douthat, for falsely claiming that I misrepresented things in my ads, and then at the same time, that stipulating a few weeks before the hearing, I did misrepresent things in my ads. So when I asked him before I went to the hearing, I had no idea what he was going to answer that. What we find is that his answer is, well, I maintain both my civil suit and the position I'm taking in it and my stipulations before this board.
Well, after you learned that, and before the panel made the decision, did you seek to change your recommendation?
No, I did not. I felt bound by the recommendation because I had made it as part of the stipulations and the recommendation I had made initially in that meeting.
You're telling us that you could not change that after hearing this
Well, I
believe
I could have.
But you didn't.
But I didn't. And upon reflection of reviewing the record, I think that the board is justified. But I'm not changing what I recommend as I stand here today, because I consider myself to have made a deal. And I'm not going to back away from that.
Did the board hear anything else? So what would cause the board, if you have any idea, to change the panel's recommendation?
I don't have any direct information, obviously, but I think that they've looked at the circumstances here. I would like this court to consider some of the circumstances, which include the fact that this respondent knew a lot about the sign preparation process. But one of the things the board focused on was that his knowledge his prior knowledge of the offenses or the misconduct. He knew before a single sign was painted that he was entering into an arrangement with a township trustee to have his signs painted for free labor. He gets free labor in exchange for donating the signs, the lumber from the signs, to the township after the election. He made that deal before a single sign was painted.
And he knew how they were going to be done and who was going to be doing them?
Well,
or did he just turn that over to the trustee?
He claims he turned over the management of the sign preparation process to his close friend and neighbor, Chuck Gillen, who was working with the trustee. But what he finds out during the sign preparation process, 2 weeks into it, is that the signs are being prepared at the township garage. So now he not only has entered into an arrangement with a trustee where he's going to donate the lumber to the township afterwards, he now finds out that the signs are being prepared at the garage. All that is significant knowledge on his part. His response to that was simply to move the work to another location, not because he was concerned that it was happening at the garage, because it was a township garage, but because it was raining, the precipitation was coming through. It was leaking at the garage, and it was cramped in space. They moved it as a matter of convenience.
How do we know that that's the only reason?
That's what he testified to at the deposition. That's what's in the stipulations. It's the only thing he testified to.
I'm concerned about how you arrive at the interpretation that South Ohio's top prosecutors and sheriffs has got to mean all elected sheriffs and prosecutors. If you were to translate that into French, they'd immediately put the word some in front of it.
I understand, Your Honor. I would simply indicate that what I looked at in reviewing this, and I asked this court to consider, is that this is from the position of the public that we must look at it. What would the members of the residents of the 14 counties say when faced with that advertisement? Would they say simply, oh, I know that only means some? Or would they say, well, the top prosecutor and top sheriff in my county is the elected guy?
Well, have you ever heard the elected prosecutor called the top prosecutor? Isn't it, in fact, a phrase more reserved for the unelected staff?
Not in my experience, Your Honor. The top prosecutor is the elected prosecutor.
He's merely the top of a list. He isn't a unique thing that's totally different. I've never heard him referred to that way. And I don't know what the public thinks. And I don't think we can say what the public would know that phrase top to mean.
I agree we can't interpret exactly what all the members of the public would interpret that phrase to mean. But I think we have to look at what he was putting out to the public. You have to look at the ad as well. Right above that phrase is a map of Southern Ohio. And on that map are designated all the county seats. Below it, usually, is a picture of him standing next to somebody in a uniform. I think the clear import of the entire message is he's endorsed by all the top sheriffs and prosecutors.
Wouldn't the clear import be that that particular picture says that that man endorsed him? Mm-hmm. And not even that, that the two were talking together. If you hear an ad that says, doctors endorse this, do you think the public really believes that all doctors endorse it? Aren't we used to advertising? Isn't this what we all in law school called puffery?
I agree that it can be considered puffery, but when you go so far as to claim to be endorsed by the top sheriffs and prosecutors, and in fact, you're only endorsed by one of 14 prosecutors, the stipulations were that he was endorsed and or supported by three of the 14 prosecutors. If you look at what's behind that, which are the affidavits filed in the pretrial papers in this matter, only one prosecutor actually endorsed him out of 14. Two more said they supported him but did not endorse him because they were members of the opposite political party. So I submit that it is entirely false for him to assert an endorsement by the top prosecutors, plural, when he actually had one, and he knew that. He also has indicated he only asked for the endorsement of three. He only sought three people's endorsement out of 14. That's misleading to the public. And that's why we feel that's a violation.
When did he start using this in the campaign? The primary campaign was fairly short. Did he begin using it early in the primary campaign?
I don't have a date for when it started, but he has acknowledged that he submitted, this is his testimony at the hearing, that he utilized over 20,000 pieces of literature with that endorsement claim on it. He's also indicated it appeared in numerous newspaper ads. It was on radio spots. It was well disseminated throughout the entire 4th Judicial District.
Well, the reason I'm curious is that I've served on the panel that fast-tracked the claim to get them resolved in time so that the individual who feels aggrieved by the exaggeration can have some determination that the electorate can know about. And I'm kind of curious as to why these two minister court judges didn't pursue the fast-track information of whether, in fact, that Evans was exaggerated, who was endorsing.
I can only give you what I understand to be the circumstance. On April 30th is when we know they called Attorney Saxby. Their concern was these ads were misleading, among other things.
We only had a week to go.
Right, we only had about a week to go. Right, so I can't say why they at that point came to that conclusion. Maybe getting the two of them together, whatever, I don't know. What I do know is they didn't actually file their initial grievance with the Board of Commissioners until June. So the allegation in the civil suit that what they went public with was a grievance, or published the fact that they had filed a grievance, I don't know where that comes from. They didn't file for another month. And that's what the respondent testified to at the hearing, and it's in the civil suit, but I have no idea where that comes from.
What does the record show about how much of the signs were done and what value you place on them if they weren't done? In other words, how do you report that labor expended, and how do you place a value on the labor if the sign has no value to it? In other words, what was he supposed to do?
Well, I think there's two issues here. One is he needed to report that he actually received this in-kind contribution. The second issue, which he focuses on, is what's the value of that contribution? Now, I don't know how you easily ascertain that value, but he certainly could have reported that he received the value of the labor. We were able to ascertain how many people worked on the signs. We were able to ascertain what days they worked on the signs.
Every campaign has hundreds of volunteers. And when I ran locally, and I'm sure almost all of us have, we have hundreds of volunteers that put signs together, nail them, and pin them, and stake them. And I've never heard that you had to report that labor as a contribution in time.
These weren't volunteers, Your Honor. These were inmates on work release who had no choice. They were removed from the jail, taken to his warehouse, and told, this is what you're going to do today.
That is a distinction you're making. You're not trying to claim that anytime you have volunteers, you have to sort of labor.
Absolutely not claiming that volunteers have to be reported. I'm saying that when the township voluntarily or involuntarily donates labor by way of inmates or welfare workers who otherwise would work for the township.
Okay, so you're drawing a distinction.
Absolutely. And I'm also contending that the use of the township garage, the use of the township truck to drive the workers, the use of the township employees to drive the workers, are all value that he obtained from the township. And I honestly don't know how you would precisely put a value to it, but he didn't report even receiving it.
But there's no evidence that he knew that these people were doing it, and that he immediately took steps to learn that the county workers were being used to stop that.
I'm glad you raised that, because we have not conceded that he did not know. What we have stipulated was that he asserts he did not know. I think if you look at the full picture...
Well, but you've got the burden of proving violations.
That's correct. That's correct.
The stipulation simply is that's what he would have testified to if he testified.
That's correct. He would have asserted, but I'm looking at this in terms of going back a few questions.
But do you have any evidence to contradict his assertions?
Just all the circumstances here? If I cut a deal with the township worker to provide together, I get free labor, which I'm very pleased about, in exchange for providing lumber later. I find out it's being done at the township garage, and I move it, and I go out and I meet some of these folks, and my next-door neighbor and best friend is there almost every day. And I've worked and lived in this county my entire life. I've been heavily involved in politics. I think it flies in the face of reason to say, I have no idea who's making my signs.
In a campaign where I believe he's in how many counties in that
14 counties.
14 counties. He's traveling in that geography. And you think he has daily information about this? Or how often do you think he knew about it?
The person who was driving him was Mr. Gillum, the man in charge of the signs. So daily contact with the person in charge of the signs. Mr. Gillum's assertion is that he didn't know about the sign making, even though he drove these workers on four separate occasions, picking them up right outside the jail, dropping them off right outside the jail on four occasions. It's only the fourth time that he does that. He says, oh, these people must be from the jail.
Did the panel say we hereby find by clear and convincing evidence that he knew that, in other words, that's the critical determination?
I agree. What I was going to get to is I'm not saying that this is something that is a direct violation because we proved it by clear and convincing. We haven't. I agree with that. But it is a circumstance that this court, I think the board took into consideration as an aggravating factor. That the circumstances here just don't look right.
Let me ask you, I assume it's fair to look at the government's two proceedings like the Burek case where the judge engaged in somewhat similar conduct. Six separate violations of the campus, and Mr. Burek was publicly reprimanded and fined $7,500. Should we look at that in reference to this particular sanction here where we have a judge suspended for 6 months? I think I know what I make, Judge Evans makes. That breaks down to a substantially higher fine than $7,500.
It does, Your Honor, but I think that I would suggest the court should look at all the factors, the extent of the injury to the judiciary and the whole legal profession by all three violations here. The sign misconduct is very serious. Alleging that he's endorsed by the top law enforcement officials is a very serious false claim. And I think that there are differences between that and our situation in the Burke case and others like the Roberts case.
How would you allocate the two counts in the decision?
I've never tried to break them out as to how it should be allocated.
Since I have serious doubts about the first count three, I guess it is, I'm trying to understand how it would affect the whole decision. Because I see the count three as puffery. And everything that falls out of that, the mitigation and remorse, all depends upon that count. And if it isn't there, I'm not sure what's left.
Well, you certainly have count one, the two violations of count one. But I would submit that when you claim to be endorsed by the top sheriffs and prosecutors, and you do not, in fact, have that endorsement, those endorsements, you are misleading the public. The public relies on that in making judgment about judges as to who should be elected. They don't know these folks. They don't have 14 counties. They don't know the respondent.
Isn't the important thing, though, that there was a stipulation that the canon was violated?
Absolutely. I mean, I was going to get to that point myself.
But it could...
All of this has been stipulated. You're being asked to undercut what he's already agreed to. I gave up proving my case in exchange for these stipulations, and now I'm being told, oh, well, the stipulations don't matter anyway.
Well, it could be de minimis, though. The question of how much.
I understand.
I have another question, and that is, I see no value given. I don't know how many hours the inmates spent, how many inmates, how many signs.
Again, that was something we would have proved if we had a hearing. But by virtue of him admitting that this is misconduct, we gave up the opportunity to try to prove up all that was involved, short of what was...
But it goes to the severity of it.
That's correct. But I think that the facts that were stipulated to establish a very serious incident of misconduct here.
Well, I think the question, the whole purpose of finding out about in-kind contributions is knowing who's doing what for whom. So the public knows who's contributing to the candidate in what capacity. And unfortunately, by stipulating it, you're saying that the sign matter was serious, but we have no way of knowing how serious. We don't know how many signs we're talking about.
It is stipulated there were 200 pieces of 8x8 plywood utilized to make 4x4 and 4x8 signs. We're talking about a lot of lumber here.
And we don't know the value of the lumber versus the value of the man hours, which might have been, the lumber might have been more expensive than the man hours. And we don't know how many signs were completed of the 200. It could have been one or two.
That's correct. By virtue of him admitting the misconduct, I chose not to introduce that. And I apologize if the court finds that it's
Mr. Kogel. Mr. Eiler, we'll give you 2 minutes to sum up.
Thanks very much, Chairman. You know, when I listen to the argument that's made here, I find none of this stuff in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. I mean, I find none of it. I find an elaboration of some of these facts that are just put in and dropped in. The last thing I understand, the counsel said that he was found guilty of three of the counts, but are really around only two. You see, you can just keep adding and adding and adding and adding, and it's supposed to come out in due process. I just said you would find violations of three. There's only two counts. I would find that this is something that really is interesting. In the findings of fact, if we're going to stick with those, there's only two aggravating factors. Now, all the circumstantial thing that he's talking about was never in the finding of fact. There are only two circumstantial factors. One was a civil lawsuit, and the other was the use of top, that he never corrected, that he, when he used many, that was an aggravating factor. But we're supposed to know now, those are the only two aggravating factors. And both of those factors, one comes from his representation, and the other factor comes, obviously, from the evidence that was produced here. But all of a sudden now, he's made to be circumstantially beyond what the findings of fact were. So you can make up this disciplinary case as we go along. We don't have to pay attention to the findings of fact. There are three violations instead of two, and that's how things are going to be run. And you're supposed to know what everybody's doing in your campaigns. Here's the thing that concerns me about stipulations. Both signed stipulations. Now, what do they mean? I mean, I understood a stipulation to be a finding of fact that excludes any testimony there, too. But that's not enough for disciplinary counsel, because when he got to the hearing, he was asked about the civil complaint. See, and to me, that really troubles me when you're signing a stipulation to move things along, and you know that the judge has testified during, he wanted to get this over with. And so he agreed to this. I think that what's happening here is something that's in the preamble of the canons, and what the preamble says, and we put it in our brief, is this. Not every violation requires disciplinary action, and it's a common sense rule that we should follow here today. And I thank you very much, John.
Thank you. The case is submitted. Marshall will adjourn court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court.
stands adjourned.